Good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, I guess, depending on where you are. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on preparing your calling strategies for an era of limited contacts, which is being brought to you by Neustar. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has proposed a cap on the number of attempted contacts and the number of conversations that collectors may have with individuals. Following a number of states that have established call caps, it appears that this trend may be going nationwide. In this webinar, we've got experts from the credit collection industry who are here to share their insights into how collection operations can maximize their calling campaigns to get the highest possible right party contact rates. As I mentioned, this webinar is being generously sponsored by Neustar. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program today. I want to take a quick word and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insight to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Robert Blair is currently the Director of Data Systems and Contact Strategy at Valor Intelligent Processing. At Valor, Robert is responsible for managing the data systems and driving the company's contact strategy. He has been in the ARM industry for more than 10 years and is focused on using analytical data to increase performance, efficiency, and revenue. Todd Meeks is a Product Director in Risk Solutions Product Management, specializing in first and third-party collection solutions to improve customer interaction success. Todd recently joined Neustar after 9 years at Citigroup as a Senior Vice President of Global Channel Strategies, where he solved outbound dialing, TCPA, and multi-channel communication challenges. Before Citigroup, Todd served in leadership roles at Fifth Third Bank, Broadwing Communications, and Cincinnati Bell. Todd has a Bachelor of Science in Computer Information Systems from DeVry University. Matt Wolk is a senior director on Neustar's fraud, risk, and compliance team. He is a 21-year veteran of call center analysis and operations, specializing in the outsourcing and collections to improve revenue performance for both clients and vendors. Prior to Neustar, Matt worked at Capital One for 10 years, managing the collection agency outsourcing, along with legal collection outsourcing. After Capital One, Matt was responsible for the network of attorneys, along with strategy and analysis for Track America. But most recently was responsible for operations, client management, and business development for a division of CBE companies. Matt has a BBA along with a minor in math and history from Radford University. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net's webinar recordings page. Finally, I just want to ask everyone to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation and your feedback helps me develop the content that's what you're looking for, such as the topic we have for you today, and to find the speakers you want to hear from, which is definitely the case with the people we have with us today. And with that, let's move on from me talking, which is what nobody wants to hear, to our panelists, which is what everybody's here for today. So let's start by sort of framing the discussion. Todd, we'll give you the honor of the first question. What is your current view on where the industry is related to RPCs, right party contacts, and optimization?
So I think that the industry overall, we're at a early stage of optimizing all the data that's available for RPCs. I think we're also in a period of time that where the importance of optimal data has been put a little bit toward the back burner due to the economy and where we stand, that it's possible for companies to make it through dialing campaigns multiple times per day. So I think that it's going to, as we go more toward the end of this kind of bull market, that we will look for higher and higher levels of importance on optimal numbers to dial and optimization of all dialing strategies. So that's one of the questions that I have is, where in this cyclical pattern are most of the most companies today? I know that about 10 years ago, we were at the other end of that that cyclical period where dialing strategies were at the highest level of importance for receiving, you know, dialing the best numbers and the best times to call people. So that would be my question for the participants today would be where at in their dialing the cyclical piece of their strategies are they today?
Excellent. Good question. Yeah, go ahead.
And thanks, Mike. This is Matt Wolk. To Todd's point, there's those of us that have been or are in operations in the past have always seen those cycles happen. One of the things that is changing the dynamic, to Todd's point, as we come near, or I should say, as we approach the end of a bull market, is we have a new dynamic that's being entered in, and that is the proposed rules from the CFPB. Now, while none of us are experts or attorneys on the phone to comment on, you know, the technical structure of those, I think everyone in the industry is fairly well in line with saying that, you know, on some level, there's going to be some level of ability to contact or reach out to the customer. I don't want to use those key buzzwords that are causing the confusion, like attempt or contact or right party connect or what have you. But we know there's going to be some limits on that. So as you think of nearing the end of a bull market, limiting the ability to contact, identifying correct information at the consumer level becomes even that much more important, because most of the people I think on the call today will agree that even in that new world, scorecard is still going to be king. And there's a few people on this call that have heard me say that many times before. But until that world doesn't happen, that means you got to maintain liquidation rates. You got to pull liquidation forward. You got to have the highest collections. That's how you're going to achieve market share. And in that upcoming world of focusing on RPCs and optimization, if you only optimize to what you've done historically is not going to represent the new world. So you're going to have to bring in some information that makes your system, whatever AI tool or machine learning tool that you plan on using, is going to make it think differently about now, how do I optimize in a new world? But Rob, I'll turn it over to you. Any thoughts about that from the agency side?
So I would add to that, Matt, I think that we've all kind of been, asking for, some interpretation of the law, of the rules. I mean, obviously we don't get to create the rules. We just have to play by them. But I know, in my career, it's been especially tough because none of us really know what the rules were or are. Very vague, very mysterious, if you will. And I think that we all kind of welcome interpretation and, the ability to be able to say, okay, it's a black and white issue after number seven attempt. That's when you have to kind of throttle it. I mean, I think we all invite that. And of course, we don't want those rules to inhibit our business, and we want them to be able to allow us and help us and guide us towards, higher revenue numbers. I think that, a reasonable approach by the Fed as far as what we can and can't do is good, and knowing, hey, this is a black and white thing that we know, this is the exact thing that we have to go by. I think that's good. It can, especially when you look at some of the state rules that have come into play, it does kind of restrict your ability, but I think it's definitely a lot better than flying in the dark. And I think most of the peers in the ARM industry will tend to agree, especially considering, we don't necessarily have the ability to write the rules. But I do appreciate the groups that have gone down to Washington to kind of educate the legislators of our business and how it operates. And I think that's a great thing. And I think that knowing the rules to play by is definitely a good thing. And I think that's the direction that we're going.
Which actually brings full circle, going back to Todd's point of your ability to get through your file today. So if now in a new world, you're going to be limited and you have, let's assume for a second, a recession approaches, which tends to mean increased charge off, which tends to mean increased placements. Or does that make you more efficient in getting through your file or less efficient in getting through your file? If you don't have the correct RPC data and you know you can only limit the number of times to contact, you're going to be forced into making a decision. And that is, I have to get the right information in front of my people to make them as most effective and efficient as they possibly can, because I'm going to have increased volumes and less opportunity to reach.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. You know, obviously, you know, that's kind of the name of the game is how do you get the right party on the phone and how do you do it within the rules? And I mean, we all kind of have to, you know, change our strategy and have. I mean, what worked for me 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 1 year ago, doesn't work as well now. So I think the biggest takeaway of whether, you know, no matter what the rules end up being or what the interpretation and it'll probably change next year and the year after that and so on and so forth. I think just really staying in your data and really, you know, looking at the numbers and really, you know, keeping your finger on the trigger as to, you know, if you see a decline, if you see an increase, if you see an opportunity, you know, really getting in that data and seeing what works and seeing what doesn't. Because I think all too often what tends to happen is, you know, folks just kind of continue to fly the way they always have been. And then one day they look down and their RPC rate cut in half from what it was a year ago because, you know, they didn't change. They didn't, you know, get in the data to really get an idea of what is working and what isn't working, you know?
Right. Yep.
I think that's a great sort of way to frame it, Robert, sort of staying in your data. And I wanted to sort of maybe just flesh that out a little bit. I know we've, you know, there might be people listening now or on the recording, but how do you kind of know when you're looking at your data, you know, whether or not you're looking at sort of a, you know, an actual sort of cause and effect, or, you know, is there always sort of like one thing that you can point to that say, well, that's the reason our RPC rate dropped, or, you know, are there already sort of different variables that you should be looking at? How do you kind of not get lost in the data, I guess, as you're doing this analysis?
Sure. I think the biggest thing for me is to have strong controls and be able to first identify that, hey, there is a change. You know, B, look at, you know, minor things that may be happening with the economy or the weather, or, you know, you don't want to take a bad day and say, well, we need to change everything, you know. Really kind of looking at it, looking for trends, and then, you know, coming up with a good control to be able to say, okay, you know, based upon the data that I'm seeing, I think by making this change, the result will be this, and then testing it to make sure that your hypothesis is right. And if your hypothesis is right, then now how do you scale that? How do you take that test that you did and then put that to scale for your organization or your call center, your enterprise? And really, a lot of times what folks do is they have a feeling, they have an idea, but they, you know, they don't really know how to test it. They don't really know how to scale it. They don't really know, you know, how to implement it. So I think it's a team effort. I mean, you got to have your data guys in there to give you the data that you need. You have to have your strategy guys in there to talk about it with your operations people. What are they hearing? What, you know, what's happening on the phones? Is it, you know, is it an agent disposition issue? I mean, there's so many different variables that come into play. You really have to take some, you know, a couple of steps back, group with your team, and kind of look at it from a 50,000 foot view to determine what's changed and then how do we get ahead of that curve.
And I think, Rob, you hit on a key point right there at the end. It's getting back to the 50,000 foot view, right? I mean, there are always times where a client makes a dramatic change in what you can or can't do. And you can always point back and look at that one day you made the change and say, that is the change. That is the difference. Most commonly, though, it's not, right? They'll make subtle changes, or you'll get regulatory changes or what have you. So there's subtleties that happens. But at the end of the day, we all know collections, third-party collections, even first-party collections for the most part, is not rocket science. A lot of times you filter out the, okay, we know it's not this, we know it's not that, we know it's not this. You filter out the knots, and then kind of the as the rule goes, it is, if that is the most likely impact, then that must be the impact. I can't think of the actual scientific name for that rule, but thank you. So I think that becomes your important part, right? Of going back to the 50,000 foot view, looking down from the top and saying, okay, clearly it's none of these other things. So it, and even if you're bold enough to say it must be this, even if you say it might be these one or two things, adjusting to those one or two things over a period of time, and Rob, to your point, not sweeping changes because of one bad day. You guys are located in Florida. You have a bad day because everybody was shutting down because of a hurricane coming through. All right, you can't do anything about that, right? So you're not going to make sweeping changes because you are negatively impacted by the weather.
Great point. Matt, I'm curious, sort of looking at this sort of operationally, one of the things you mentioned before was sort of the importance of bringing in new information. So I'm curious, and you're talking about sort of the weather and things like that, how far ahead should companies be planning as they're trying to sort of shift the way they approach this and sort of be less backward looking and more forward looking?
Well, that's the age old question, right? It's, when do you start making a change? I don't know that there's ever not a bad time to start looking at change. And yes, I realize there was a double negative in that response. but it's always looking for what is going to get me ahead. So we all recognize and realize that there are, if you're already in first place and at max market share for a particular client, you don't want to overinvest to maintain that position. But if you're last on the scorecard and they've given you 6 more months before, they being the client, they've given you 6 more months or 9 more months to turn it around, or are going to be forced to make a sudden change, that, those are the two opposite ends of the spectrum, right? In one hand, you're forced to do it. So, and again, I'm gonna go back to what Todd was saying earlier about the economy being good. We tend to get complacent as operators when things are looking pretty good. So I think always at least a 6-month runway of what should we expect to change, what can we expect to change, what are we expecting to change, and what can we do about it. And to bring in Rob's point about testing into it, making those small changes, because that allows you to make small changes as you go to constantly get better, versus that other scenario where suddenly you're forced into it and you have to change everything that you've been doing. But Todd, you and I had a good conversation the other day about that getting complacent in the good economic times. Do you want to touch a little bit on that from our conversation the other day?
Yeah, so if the number of outbound dials is meeting your needs on a daily basis in the good times, it does allow you to kind of get complacent, but it also gives you an opportunity to look at the next evolution of what will you do in the bad times, and it gives you that leeway to do some of the testing that Rob was commenting on, that you're able to, what is the next evolution of data that's going to help you not only achieve the RPC, but then subsequently get that promise or that payment. So what right now in the industry, it's typically attempting to get that RPC, then it comes down to the agent to close. But things that we look at are, probability to be able to pay, and not just the single number or the broad pool of numbers that are going to be able to be contacted, but the best contactability. So being able to take the time now, since you have excess in the good times, to test into those next strategies and what additional data would be necessary. And that's what we look at, is what is the data necessary for the next phase of this ability to, not only achieve the RPC, but get that P2P and close the deal for a payment.
Yeah, so just to piggyback on Todd's comment a little bit further, in looking at, some of the slides you're seeing right now, that where we have contactability scores, it's being able to identify through a number of different variables which of those phone numbers best goes with Matt Wolk. And as Rob and I have joked in the past, clients, will often say, hey, look, I just gave you 5 more phone numbers per account. And you like to, you want to say thank you, but at the same time, you're like, oh my gosh, they just made my life worse. Because now you don't know which phone number is better. Being able to look at that external data, going back to your question, Mike, of help me understand which of these is the best number. There have been occasions in the past as an operator where people would say, well, it looks like we get most of our RPCs between 3 and 5 p.m. Well, that's great, but I can't call every account in my inventory between 3 and 5 p.m. Not to mention the fact each one of those accounts is going to be unique in and of their own right. So how do I know when I should call an account? How do I know which is the best number to call? It's those types of external data where, just getting information from your client placement file is not necessarily going to help you get there, but it's bringing in some of that other data that allows you to say, okay, this is what's going to cause me to be most effective, and in many cases, most efficient.
Yeah, those are both great points. I think I would add to that to say, obviously, webinars like this, peer conversations. I know, Matt and I, we've talked about, how can I get better? What did you do? What are you seeing? I think that camaraderie that we have in the ARM industry is great, because, even though we all compete against each other, we're all a brotherhood. And, I think that, plenty of guys that I know would have no problem, take a call. Here's what I'm struggling with. Here's what I'm seeing. What are you seeing? And I think that that's great, because, sometimes you may not think of something that someone else, like, oh yeah, we had that issue. Yeah. This, here's how we kind of worked it out. And, obviously you keep your secrets close to the vest, but at the end of the day, like you said, Matt, it's not rocket science. It's just, thinking outside of the box, thinking of, something that someone else maybe didn't think about, and, kind of executing it a little bit differently. And, I think that these webinars and the resources that are online for our industry are great helps for all of us, really.
Thank you. Appreciate the nice words, Robert. And I do agree that there is definitely a rising tide lifts all boats connection in the industry. And I think that's a great thing to have. One of the things we haven't talked about yet and just wanted to maybe touch upon briefly, we'll see how the discussion goes, is the importance of alternative communication channels like email, text messaging. Certainly something that was in the proposed rule, certainly something that companies have been sort of slowly rolling out as they sort of get comfortable with it, either from an operational or a compliance standpoint, but it definitely is something that could impact communication and RPC and collection rates. So curious just to sort of get any sense or any insights that the panel might have. Todd, would you mind going first?
Yeah, from the alternate channels perspective, I think that there are more and more often difficulties in pulling together kind of an overall omni-channel strategy. So I think that is one piece where there will be opportunities going forward to componentize the omni-channel strategy, so that a lot of the existing legacy infrastructure can be used, and then again providing the data backbone for that to understand how those omni-channel strategies are working. So if I have a campaign where I send out a text message and the customer isn't necessarily going to respond to the text, but they log into our website, or they do an inbound call to the IVR, that is likely, and over time you could determine how likely that was, that it was caused by that other outbound channel. So I think that one of the keys going forward is going to be really determining, pulling together that data backbone strategy to determine the effectiveness of each channel and how they interact. So I think that implementing that is going to be one of the hurdles that people see, because it's really difficult to do the kind of big bang implementation of an overall omni-channel platform, and it's just more likely that they'll do it from more of a component standpoint.
Excellent, thanks. Robert, Matt, anything you want to add on that, or you want to move on?
I mean, the only thing that I would probably add would just be, you have to move towards it at some point. I mean, I think that there's a lot of folks that are still, you know, kind of scared to dip their toe in the pool. But, obviously with your different age groups, if you're calling 55 and up, telephone's probably your best bet. But, you know, when you're trying to reach 18 to 25, you know, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like 90% or maybe it's 85% of text messages get received and responded to within 5 minutes, not exclusive to the, our industry, but just in general. So just goes to show you that, just like we talked about before, you have to constantly evolve. And I think kind of moving towards the text and the email and the omni-channel approach, I think we all agree is a good thing. And it's just kind of getting those chief compliance officers to say, yeah, let's go for it. That's probably the biggest struggle right now.
So Rob, do you have data today that allows you to do some of the segmentation that you were talking about, like based upon likelihood of utilizing the channel? Do you have access to some of that data that's going to say, you know, the 18 to 30 year olds or whatever are more likely to respond to a text message? Are you able to acquire that data today?
No, so I don't have any industry specific or, specific to our group. Valor's a relatively new creation. I mean, the last 6 months we started business. So there is data out there, and obviously, aggregating that and then making decisions upon that. I mean, we're looking at that, but from a high level perspective, just and not industry specific, but just cultural specific, I a lot of people that you talk to kind of in my demographic or my generation and back, they just don't answer the phone as much as they did 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I think that getting that data is key and it's important. But even before you have that data, if you have the ability to run a text campaign, run an email campaign, I can tell you that the callbacks from a text campaign are great, but having that link where they can just make that payment and then tracking that, like you said, is super important. But I just don't have all of that data aggregated to be able to say, this is the exact time you want to send a text, and this is the exact age group that it works, and this is the age group that it doesn't. But we will have that data very soon, for sure.
You know, the alternative communication channels, let's all be realistic. Email's been around for a long time, even in the collection industry. It's been tried in many different districts and many different circuits of what is right and not right. And I think everybody has a good sense for what they have today or what is acceptable today. When you look at texting, it's a relatively new world. I think I heard one of my machine learning, artificial intelligence counterparts on a panel say it best one time, which is, whatever you do, don't rush into it. Test it, back to Rob's point. Get the data, back to Todd's point. Understand where it's going to be most effective. And, by all means, get the clients on board with it too. One of the things about alternate communication channels, and I've heard this in a bunch of industry discussions before, is a lot of people asking, why don't we have the technology to communicate in the way that other industries communicate? Having the technology is not the question. Having the ability is the question. When you look at how goods and services are marketed today, it's through, I mean, that's the epitome of omnichannel. It's everywhere where you go. When you get to collections, there's a certain regulatory impact that says, wait, hold on a second. You can't use all of those methods for different reasons and purposes. You get into a lot of the regulations at that point. So the ability is there. Back to Rob's point of, we start getting back to chief compliance officers and what their role is, and that's saying, hey, I need to reduce the risk amount as much as possible. But if you test your way into it and you find that the risk is low, then that allows you to move at a different pace. Also, getting the client buy-in is going to be an important part also of making sure they understand what you're doing, how you're doing it, how it's in compliance, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it still comes back to one of the key pieces that started out for email going back, 5 years ago, is how do we know it's the right email address? How do we know we're sending this to the right person? And it goes back to Mike, a question you asked of me earlier, which is external data. How do you know you have the right information? And that is, there are people out there, Neustar being one of them, that has the ability to corroborate information and say, this is your best bet. And so in order to move down that path of alternate communication, it's not just starting a texting campaign or starting a chat campaign or starting an email campaign. It's your first step is, well, if I'm going to reduce risk, I got to know, or at least have to have some reasonable confidence that where I'm sending it is the person it's intended to go to.
So, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just think that the question of omnichannel is also dependent on or different based between the first and third party collections teams.
Sure.
That if I'm a first party collector, that means that I've owned that customer for quite some time. So I may have built a communication rapport with them over time. So I may have sent them a text message saying, welcome to whatever bank, and then over time sent some reminders of payments due or just communicating with the customer. And that gives them more of a confidence that with all the spam and spoofing that's out there right now, that when you send them something, they have a higher likelihood of responding or taking that as valid, whereas a third party hasn't had that multi-year relationship with the customer to develop that.
Sure.
So that's going to be more difficult. So I think in those cases, it's even more kind of, Matt, to your point, to have that data to know that you have the right communication and the right person that's receiving that communication, so that they have a quicker turnaround in building that rapport with the customer for them to understand that who is communicating them with them is valid.
Yeah, fair point.
And I was just going to add, like I said, everybody wants to know a good place to start. How do they get their foot in the pool? And I tell you, a good way to start is going to be, if you're talking about texting, what about folks that you've already talked to? You already know the number, you already know that they're going to answer it. Maybe they ghost you. Maybe they stop picking up the phone. At the end of the day, once you have X amount of no answers, hey, there's no sense in me calling that anymore. That history has shown that if they don't answer after 10 times, they're probably never going to answer. But that's where that texting and the email campaigns are very valuable, because much, much cheaper, very, very low resource, it's not resource depleting to send a text campaign or send an email campaign. You already know you have the right information. So that's a really good place to start if you're looking to start that. And obviously your contacts are much smaller scale, so you're not sending 100,000 blind texts off to rando numbers to give your compliance officer a heart attack, but you can start small. That's what I would recommend. And, you have the data to know it's the right person. You maybe you lost a rapport, maybe they wrote a bad check, whatever. But you're able to then kind of look at that and be able to say like, hey, you know, we got a callback, or they went to the website or whatever the case may be. And then from there you can, you know, help build your test case to be able to say like, let's do this on a mass scale, and here's what I think the ROI would be based upon what we've already seen. But like you guys said, you know, really having that number and knowing the right number is key, and doing all of that, because you certainly don't want to spend more money sending text to the wrong number and increase your, you know, risk of, you know, being sued for it.
Right.
Okay, excellent. I'm curious, I'd like to get insights. Maybe Robert, you could go first. You know, the CAPB has put a number out there in terms of what their call cap will be, you know, for conversations, for communications, and I'm just curious. You know, one of the things, I read through most of the comments that were filed with the CAPB, certainly not all of them, but most of them, and I was kind of hoping that someone was going to say, we tried this, you know, based on the framework that you've laid out, here's how our right party contact, here's how our collection rates were affected. And I don't really recall seeing that. I'm curious if it's something you've started, you know, you've either tested or internalized. And then Matt and Todd, if it's something you've seen, I'm just curious if there's any, you know, if people are sort of looking at how, you know, sort of changing the number of calls or conversations or attempts is actually impacting a company's, you know, RPC and collection rates.
Well, I think it really kind of depends on your business model and your resources. You know, I've worked at shops where we had tons of resources and tons of money we're willing to spend on, you know, those types of campaigns or those types of moves. And, you know, if you have the ability and the resources, you know, to make as many calls as you want, then, you know, it's probably going to hurt your bottom line. You know, it may be a situation where, you know, maybe you're just way oversaturated, and, you know, maybe you're penetrating more than you really need to. Like Matt said, you're solid number one, but you're investing more money than you really need to. But you know, if you're a, you know, like most shops where you are constantly looking at the P&L and constantly looking to see like, you know, hey, do we have too many resources here? Can we move resources over there? You know, I generally think most of us, or at least in my experience with the dialing strategies that I've come up with, we're kind of already in that, kind of in those kind of proposed rules, if you will. I mean, you know, I've definitely been in a position where, hey, I'm over penetrating the heck out of this because, you know, I really need to get to number one, or I really need to get this batch back up. So it can definitely hurt there if you're chasing scorecard rankings and, you know, you want to just dump a bunch of resources and a bunch of calls into a particular batch, probably more than you could, and you have diminishing returns, but you know, this is my last shot to get this paid, and I can potentially lose this business, yada, yada. You know, but I think that most of us, or at least myself, you know, have kind of seen this coming, have been able to kind of plan for this. And, you know, our compliance teams have already, like, even before the proposed rulings came out, are already kind of looking at this and saying like, hey, we called the guy 100 times, probably not the best thing to do, you know? So you can kind of, I think we're already kind of, we're moving towards that. It's nice to have kind of, you know, or hopefully we'll have a more black and white concrete, you know, number that we can live by. But like I said, we don't get to write the rules. We just have to play by them. And at the end of the day, I think that all of us, if we really look at the data and really play by the rules, you know, we're going to be able to make money. We just have to, you know, branch out, reach out and try to do things differently than we have done. And, you know, with some particular markets or some particular clients, you may find that, man, you know, I slowed down calling, I didn't over penetrate, and my RPC rates went up. Like, you know, mm-hmm. calling the same guy, you know, 5 times a day, you know, every other hour for 6 months is not profitable. So I think that it's a good and bad thing. It's not good that, you know, you're handcuffed to a particular number. But at the same time, I think that we can all still make money with the proposed rules, give, you know, provided they're not too draconian.
Yeah, there have been, you know, I would shudder to think that there's probably not agencies out there right now who haven't put some type of call caps in place.
Right.
Some people do it by account level, having multiple phone numbers on an account. Some people do it by phone level. But in some way, everybody's done it. That because the TCPA exposure is what forced everyone into that realm of, okay, if you know, in one of the slides in here, you actually see this line graph of diminishing returns, and it's from an early out client that we did, but you can actually see just from their own data, the more attempts you make, the lower your RPC rate becomes. Going back to Rob's point of at some point everybody's already realized, I can't keep calling the same person over and over because it doesn't make sense. It's not getting me anything. And there have been states out there where they have, I'm going to use Rob's words to describe it as draconian, where they severely limited your number of attempts. And everyone will tell you the same. Yes, RPC or RPCs and collections and liquidation went down in that state. It's pretty definitive. I say that state. There's been more than one. But it's going to come back to, again, to Rob's point, making the most and identifying the portfolios where it doesn't make sense to continue calling somebody. I think what we've all come to accept, or at least most of us are getting to that point of accepting, is the world of just being able to blindly call everybody as many times as you want, as many times as you can, they're over. In fact, they've been over, and I think everybody realizes that. So now it's, how do I make the most out of my resources? My resources not only being the dollars that I have to spend, but the people that I have available. So how do I make those most effective and most efficient? Because at the end of the day, I don't think there's an agency out there that would disagree with this when I say, if everybody I called picked up the first time and we came to a resolution after that right party contact, there's no need for me to call them again. The unfortunate world is in collections is that people see your number and they just don't want to talk to you. So that's why you're going to try them again.
Well,
channel strategies also went down that path too. That, text messaging and email became a little bit more prevalent. This has been several years ago. I think that, I always use the term. Initially, it was so less expensive to do those types of channels. It was kind of the carpet bombing methodology that just send out. If one email was effective, then 10 would be 10 times more effective. And I think a lot of companies did see that that wasn't actually the case, that it did become, there was some kind of saturation point where you had diminishing returns on the responses. So I think that kind of triggered a lot more of the analytics around the effectiveness of directed and very specific contacts, not just in those channels. That I think brought it to light, but I think even through the dialing channels that was also brought to light.
And Todd, let's also not forget your point from a while ago, too. Also, the difference between first and third party. In first party, where you have that relationship, before it's been outsourced, it's still part of the, either bank XYZ or company XYZ. That's a different level of relationship, right? So you have an opportunity to do more of those things, probably more often.
I wanted to see if we could maybe drill down a little bit into how to get people to answer the phone. Not only are we talking about limiting the number of times they're trying to call, but in an era of call blocking and spam tagging and fraud risk, phone calls, labels showing up on people's phones, what can collection agencies do to try and maximize their chances that individuals will actually pick up the phone when called?
Yeah, this is Matt. I'll start with that one. If you look at tagging, spam tagging, scam tagging for those on the phone, and then also the caller ID, if you go back to when this first came out, back at the end of 2017, really is when it first started, into the beginning of 2018, there was a bunch of tags out there, and the tagging was because, the FCC basically said, hey, carriers, you guys need to figure out how to stop all these bad people from calling consumers. Well, the inadvertent or the unintended consequences that affected everybody, not just collection agencies, but every company out there. And the world that we've moved into today is now that the type of tag is going to help determine whether or not a call gets blocked. And you know, some carriers have different definitions of what blocked even means at this point. So some blocked means I'm not even going to deliver this phone call to the device or voicemail or anything. It's just never going to go through our network. And some people, it means I'm not going to ring the phone, but I'll send it straight to voicemail. So in today's world, where more and more calls or outbound phone numbers are becoming tagged, whether it's a spam likely or scam likely or scam possible or possible fraud or telemarketer or what have you, we all know, and I'm sure we all have that service on our phones today. I don't know about you guys, but I don't answer those calls. So even if it was somebody calling to say, hey, I have a free $1 million with no strings attached to you, I probably wouldn't answer it. I'd miss the call. The tagging has become such an important part, because we've seen time and time again where connect rates have gone down. And by removing the tagging and just allowing people the opportunity to answer the phone, as opposed to giving them a predefined or a predisposed decision by showing a scam tag when your phone starts ringing, is allowing people to at least get the allowing agencies and companies to get those people on the phone to understand what it is that they're whatever call that they don't want to answer, or they don't want to have that conversation or what have you. But the first step is you've got to at least remove something that's deciding for them. And you know, again, through Neustar, the being able to correct the caller ID, being able to register those phone numbers and remove all of the tags and monitor the tagging so it doesn't happen again, becomes a very key piece. And just to kind of finish that point, you look at the world of even where you have companies that are, you know, have dived a little bit more heavily into the texting world than others. Now, granted, nobody's doing it 90% of their portfolio, have you? But the phone call is still going to be an important piece. And if the response to your text message is, I'd rather do this over the phone or whatever the form or fashion it is, and then you call them and it shows scam likely, they're still not going to answer your call. So my point being, the more you correctly brand yourself, the more you remove those tags, the more you remove those predisposed decisions for the consumer, the higher your connect rate. And then that comes down to, now, are you calling the right person?
Great points, Matt. And I'll add on to that to say, really finding whether you do it through a vendor or you're just a whiz and you figure out how to do it yourself, identifying the numbers that you're using, that you're broadcasting, that are showing up as a spam or scam or, extortion, right, Matt?
Yep.
your numbers are showing up as, you need to be able to identify that. And however you choose to do that, that is key, obviously, like I said, we're a startup company at Valor. So, when we started, really digging into that and how can we improve our RPC rates? And I was very surprised to learn how many of our telephone numbers were showing up as scam or spam and how quickly by swapping those numbers out, using a different number, how quickly that can increase your RPC rates. One thing I didn't even really know is that numbers can spam out and cool down and spam out again. I mean, just really learning about how that works, and it's all way, way, way above my head. And I secretly think there's some sort of secret formula that nobody wants anyone to even know about how it works. But, ultimately identifying the numbers that are that you're using that are showing up as spam, and just knowing to swap them out or replace them or however, whatever strategy you design. I mean, that is going to be probably one of the single biggest things that a operator or a, you know, whoever's running your dialing strategy is going to be able to do to increase your RPC rates overnight. And literally when I started kind of swapping those numbers out more often, more frequently, I mean, you can literally see it on the line graph of like, that's the day that I did it. That's the hour that I did it. You know, you can visually see it on a graph, how much of a change that makes. So I would say that's the biggest, most important thing is identifying the spam numbers, swapping them out as quickly as you can.
Yeah, and Rob, you bring up a couple of interesting points. Is first, you're right, there is a science in the algorithm, and it's the carrier's analytics providers who won't tell you exactly what the science is, but they'll tell you it's based on volume changes and crowdsource feedback. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, let's be, you know, to Rob's point about as a smaller company, it's easier to be able to swap numbers in and out. But what we've seen actually is, and depending on the volume that you're actually pulsing out, we've seen numbers become tagged, a brand new number become tagged in as recent or as quickly as a couple hours. And part of that reason is because we know the algorithms have become very, very sensitive to changes in volume or spikes in volume. But when you get to a point where you have thousands upon thousands of numbers that you're using for outbound, you know, it becomes a little bit more, it becomes quite the task in order to manage all, you know, the changing of those numbers pretty consistently. And even if you don't have, and even if you don't have thousands of numbers to go out there, you know, I come back to how recently we've seen new numbers being tagged because of that spike in volume. And I'm sorry, Rob, I think I interrupted you.
No, I was kind of speaking in between you, and expensive. There's a delay on the, but it's super expensive just to, you know, like you said, we are a small shop. So for us, it works better to swap those numbers out. Not a lot of volume there, but in some of my previous roles at different shops, yeah, it would be, not only would it be resource intensive to swap all of the numbers that we had out, but it would be just astronomically expensive to think that we can just throw away, you know, these 3,000 numbers and get 3,000 new numbers every single day. So it depends on your shop and, you know, how many dials you're making and whatnot. But for us, you know, the swapping out kind of works, but that's not as scalable as some other solutions that may be out there that can, you know, help with the reputation of the number or, you know, help to make sure that your number doesn't show up as spam rather than kind of the swap out strategy.
Excellent. I'd like to spend a couple more minutes talking about data. You know, there is new data out there related to phone data and phone behavior that can correlate right party contacts. And I'm wondering if maybe you guys can spend a couple of minutes talking about that and how that data is different from other data sources that have attempted to answer similar questions.
Yeah, I'll start and then I'll let Todd and Rob join in as well. The, you know, if you look at the slide that's on the screen now, the contactability score, you look at, you know, the phone type and verification, you know, pretty easy out there. Most people can tell you whether it's wireless or LAN. Most people can tell you whether or not that name goes on that phone number or not. You know, one of the unique pieces that the traditional skip tracer has not been able to mix in there is phone usage. How much is that particular person? We've verified that it's this type of phone. We've authoritatively linked that name and all the other characteristics to that phone number. But is it still the right phone number to contact them on? Because you don't know whether or not it's being used in today's world. And I'll give you guys a real life example. I'm one of those few that still have a landline. It came from, you know, came with me from my old house. And in my current house, there is zero phones hooked up to it except for the alarm system. And if you look at traditional skip tracing methods, you'd be able to find, yes, that name and that address and everything authoritatively linked to that phone number, got to be the right phone number for Matt Wolk. I can tell you right now, no one's ever going to answer the inbound phone call on that line because it never makes outbound calls. So there is data out there that will suggest, unique to Neustar of how much I am actually using that phone. And we're actually going to rate that phone in that example fairly low because yes, it belongs to him, but he never uses it. So there's a difference between how often does a phone number show up on a credit report on credit files versus are they actually using that phone? And that's one of the key pieces to linking that we found in all of our analysis that directly correlates to RPC rates is how much over a couple different time periods, 2 months and 12 months, are they actually using that phone?
Yeah, and just to go with that, not just are they using it, but the best times or the times that they're using it. We also have that data that shows like a call window when the phone, so if that phone is active in the last month, what periods of time during the day is it most active, which would then lend toward the fact that they customers, since they're using the phone, they would be more likely to answer an inbound call. But I think the combination of those two is showing some really good results.
Right.
Now you just have to figure out how to get the ones that have their credit card in their hands when you call them. Then you got
Then nobody will answer because they'll think it's Big Brother. So
sorry, I just had to decline the spam risk call. I was actually getting. Well, we've just about run out of time, but before we wrap up, I'd like to invite Mitchell Young from Neustar to say a few words. Mitchell?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mike. It was a great discussion today. Thanks, everybody, for participating. Thank you for joining. We covered a lot of ground. I'll just say, come test some of our data. We'd love to run analyses with you. We know the industry is very efficient right now, and we do believe that the value of our intelligence will help you prepare for when future regulations come or economic changes come that limit your ability to get through the files you dial today or limit the number of outreaches you can make. And we've certainly seen our ability to remove spam tagging, call blocking, assist companies in improving their RPC rates, and our ability to tell you which are the best high usage phones correlates to RPCs. And you know, as you've been seeing through the slides today, those phones that are in the red and yellow categories, you may be able to get through today. But in the future, when the economy changes or regulations come, those phones will no longer be worthwhile for you to dial. And we can help you prepare and identify which phones are the best ones for you and talk through email strategies and texting strategies and call blocking removal strategies. So we love testing. We love that we now have people like Todd Meeks on the team and Matt Wolk on the team who are working to guide our product strategy and our client engagement. And we'd love to work with you on how we can assist. So thank you very much today.
Excellent. Thank you. And I want to join Mitchell in thanking Robert, Todd, and Matt for their insights and their time today. This is a complicated and dynamic situation that is always changing. And to sort of be on top of that and share up-to-date information sort of almost in real time about how you can sort of attack this topic is no small feat. So thank you very much for your time and your insights today. Also want to thank Neustar again one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.neustar.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar to help identify topics and speakers that will be the best use to you. A recording of this event will be posted hopefully by the end of today to accountsrecovery.net's webinar recordings page. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, awesome job. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.